Welcome to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's only animal rights show. I'm Sandra Kyle and you're listening to Montego Bay Spleen by French musician Saint-Germain, the chosen track of our principal guest today, Dr. Joe Wills. Dr. Wills is a lecturer in law at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom, where he researches in the fields of human rights, animal rights, and legal, political, and moral theory. He's recently written a book entitled Contesting World Order, Socioeconomic Rights and Global Justice Movements. Joe came to my attention when he wrote an excellent article on the Anita Quines case. Our listeners will remember that we recently interviewed Anita. And I'd just like to say that all our past podcasts are available on our Facebook page, Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast. When Mr. Bumble was told that the law assumes that it's the husband who dominates the wife, he replied memorably, "Well, the law is an ass." It's a phrase that comes to mind with regard to the legal status of animals in the Western world. The law regarding animals is deeply problematic, as Dr. Wills outlines in his interview. It can reward cruel behaviour and seek to punish compassionate behaviour, as the Anita Quines case showed. While progress is undeniably being made all over the world, including in New Zealand, for example, we now recognise that animals are sentient, it is also speciesist. It favours domestic animals over farmed animals, who are equally sentient. Shockingly, until recently, it was perfectly legal to kill an unwanted calf by hammering its skull in. Some laws are so flagrantly ignored, they might as well not exist. For example, in New Zealand animal welfare codes, it is stated that animals need to be given proper and sufficient food and water, adequate shelter, the opportunity to display normal patterns of behaviour, appropriate physical handling, protection from and rapid diagnosis of injury and disease. This begs a number of questions. How can a chicken raised for meat, packed with thousands of others into a dark, smelly barn floor, lying in their own excrement, competing for food their entire foreshortened life, possibly deformed because they've been engineered to make them grow too big to be able to support their own weight. A good number of them have heart failure and die where they lay before slaughter at 5 weeks old. Or a layer hen packed into a colony cage in an enormous shed, hardly able to move, deeply frustrated or driven mad in their artificial and barren environment. How can these animals display normal patterns of behaviour? And what about a sow who would normally sing to her piglets in the wild? She screams instead as she lies trapped in semi-darkness, unable to walk more than just a few steps, unable to escape her misery. At just 4 weeks of age, her babies are taken from her and she'll never see them again. She too will be slaughtered at just a fraction of her normal lifespan. As from this August in New Zealand, it will be illegal to throw baby calves just days old onto slaughter trucks. The law has had to be changed because animal rights activists placed hidden cameras revealing that roughly treating these babies was pretty standard practice. One of the points Dr. Wills makes in his very informative discussion that we will air over two programs is that the law is reactive, and this new bobby calf law, for example, is a direct result of the public outcry. And that's why continuing to speak out for animals to raise awareness about their plight is so important. So we'll get on to the first part of the interview shortly that Sarah Oliver and I conducted. But first, here's a recording of a short chat that I had with Lindley Tulloch about her experience in the caged being experiment the other weekend. So, Lindley, what was the cage like?
It was just a queer piece of cage in a unused shop space, which only gave us a very limited amount of space, about 1.2 metres squared, around the same size as a telephone box.
And how many people were in
Well, we had 40 people. Well, we were supposed to have 40 people. Some people didn't actually turn up, but they shortened the cage so that it still replicated the same conditions. So we had around 35 people, and we were there for 40 hours. So 40 caged beings for 40 hours. It was organised by SAFE in conjunction with Manifest. Manifest is a creative content agency, and they came up with the idea. The food and toilet breaks, look, we were given muesli 3 times a day, muesli and soy milk. It was raw, it was very unpalatable, and the toilet breaks, we just had breaks when we told we could go when we needed to. Of course, if there was an emergency, they would let us out.
So were there many young people?
Yes, there were a lot more young people than there were people my age. There was only one person who was older than me, and she was only older by a few months, and the rest of them were late teens, early 20s.
I admire you for doing it, but you must have known it was going to be difficult. Why did you volunteer?
I volunteered because I feel very strongly about the issue of caged chickens and pigs and the lives that they endure, and I just want to do anything I can to raise awareness and contribute to that. That's why I did it.
You've told me before that you tend to get a bit claustrophobic. How did you cope in those situations?
Oh, I didn't like it at all, and I wanted to get away from people. There comes a point in time where you just need your own space, and you can't. Trying just to lie down on the floor and close your eyes and just block everything out, but that was impossible. There was too much noise around, and people would still sort of try and talk to you anyway, so it was a very eye-opening situation. We weren't allowed cell phones, we weren't allowed books, we weren't allowed tablets, we weren't allowed any form of stimulation, so it mimicked very much the conditions.
So if you think of layer hens, for example, or chickens raised for meat, they're in semi-darkness and they're smelly environments, they're in their own excrement and probably quite noisy as well.
Yeah, and that's what they tried to do. They had a recording on of people's voices that was just monotonous, and then we also had the people talking on top of it, and yeah, it was pretty horrible.
So what did you get from the experience?
I got increased empathy and insight into what animals experience. I know that you can't mimic that exactly, and that we were aware that we were going to leave, and we knew we were there for a purpose, but it still gave me an insight into how absolutely painful it is to be held against your will for an extended period of time in cramped conditions.
For most caged animals, there is no end until it's the slaughter truck.
That's exactly the point, yes.
Now, just before you go, Lindley, just tell us about your trip out to the Greenlee Meats slaughterhouse in Moensville.
Yes, we wanted to get a little bit of film of the animals for our documentary, and I looked into the eyes of an animal who was waiting to be slaughtered. And it's very haunting, and it has affected me very deeply.
They know something, don't they? Somewhere within them.
Absolutely. They were scared. They knew something was happening. They did not know what at that point, but they definitely knew something was happening. It's an actually scary environment. And the Greenlee slaughterhouse in Moranesville, right in front of it is the Fonterra dairy factory, and the whole situation is terribly oppressive for the animals.
So you mentioned a documentary before. This is a documentary that you and Paul are filming?
Yeah, it's called This Consciousness in the Machine. So, you know, Moranesville to us really illustrated the machine, the capitalist machine, and how the industry around animal agriculture and what a torture it is for the animals concerned.
Okay, Lindley, that's our time, but thank you for everything that you do for the animals, putting yourself on the line constantly.
Thanks, Sandra.
Oh, thanks again to Lindley. Now let's go to Sarah Olivers and my interview with Dr. Joe Wills. We take up the interview at a point where Dr. Wills is commenting on the Quine's case and how it came to be that the individuals responsible for the appalling treatment of the pigs were not on trial, and the one who was trying to help them was.
As a general rule, we think that when the coercive power of the criminal justice system is used, it should be used against those who inflict harm on others, and particularly when that harm is violent. What we don't think is that state prosecutors should go after those who support the victims of violence or raise awareness of their plight. But of course, that's exactly what happened in the Crimes trial. Anita was merely trying to ameliorate the suffering of victims of violence and document the abuses that they were being subjected to. Now, if the victims she was supporting were regarded by the law as persons with basic fundamental rights, it would have been the individuals responsible for their appalling treatment who would have been on trial rather than crimes. But because the victims of violence were pigs, they are not recognized by the law as persons or individuals that possess basic fundamental rights against, for example, torture, killing or enslavement that we recognize that all humans possess. Indeed, as Justice Harris made clear in his judgment, the pigs are property and therefore can be brought into existence, reproduced, purchased, sold and traded, just like any other commodity. Once we see what's happened through the prism of the law, we can see why it was that crimes ended up in the dock and not the individuals who were inflicting such cruel treatment on the pig. According to the Canadian Prosecution Authority, Anita was interfering with the use of property, i.e. the pig. This was a dispute about property rights, a dispute between a property owner and somebody who was deemed with interfering with those property rights. The pigs and their rights were largely invisible, and that's because of how the law is structured and largely because of the status of pigs as property. Now, the law draws a sharp and, in my view, entirely arbitrary distinction between human and non-human animals when it comes to questions of rights, treatment, and personhood.
We're referring mainly to farm animals here, so we're against unnecessary suffering, but we again draw this line. We deem suffering that is necessary in some eyes through confinement, insemination, mutation, mother and offspring separation, among many others. It sort of shows the law to be, I guess, a speciesist is the word that's starting to be used more and more. Where do you think this goes in terms of, is the law morally flawed here? Can we talk about a law being morally flawed?
I certainly think we can talk about the law as being immoral. After all, most of us think that past laws that, for example, permitted slavery or denied women and black people their civil and political rights, we think they were unjust. I believe, actually, the day will come when we collectively look back at our present laws and what they permit us to do to animals as being profoundly unjust, in much the same way that we currently look back at laws that violated the fundamental rights of various humans. On the question of the relationship between law and morality, I should just say as an aside that within legal philosophy there is a school of thought that's known as natural law, and this argues that the vital component of law is that it expresses a deeper objective moral standard. And this was the position of Martin Luther King, who famously said in his letter from the Birmingham jail, he cites St. Thomas Aquinas' view that an unjust law is no law at all. Mm-hmm. Now, if we are to take this natural law view, I think that the correct position is to say that these various laws that permit these forms of abuse that are routinely practiced on farms, research laboratories, circuses, zoos, and so forth, actually lack the status of law because they are so transparently unjust. They sanction violence against innocent, vulnerable individuals who pose no threat to us. And that surely is the epitome of injustice and immorality. Now, interestingly, one of the crime's defense's arguments was that even if crime had committed the offense of mischief that she'd been charged with under the Canadian Criminal Code, she ought not to have been convicted because she had legal justification or what is known in the Canadian law as colour of right. So they argued that even if Krajicek's actions were illegal, they were born out of mercy and done without malice. So the act that she engaged in was a compassionate one aimed at alleviating the intense suffering of the pigs. Now, the defence were essentially arguing here that the application of the law in this context would have led to an injustice and therefore should not have been enforced. And they also go on to argue that her actions were in the public good because they not only were in response to concerns about animal welfare, but they were also highlighting the issues around factory farming and human health problems and wider environmental impact. Nevertheless, as you can imagine, courts will seldom accept these sort of natural law style arguments. They want to look at the law on books and what legislators meant when they put them in books, and don't want to second guess legislators or allow too much subjectivity to come into the law. In the Crimes case, Justice Harris was not prepared to entertain these sort of arguments. Now, turning to whether our current animal welfare laws are up to scrap, I think the answer there is clearly no, and they certainly do not provide adequate protection for animals. Let's begin by looking at the Canadian context. It's an offence in Canada to cause an animal unnecessary suffering, pain or injury. But of course this gives rise to a further question. When is suffering, pain and injury necessary? Historically, in the context of animal farming, the courts have addressed this question by looking at what is the standard practice in the industry. And if a practice is widespread enough, then it is regarded as legitimate, and the suffering that it inflicts is regarded as being necessary. So if, for example, in the cattle industry, branding and dehorning or debudding are routine practices, the courts will not second-guess them and will determine the suffering they inflict to be necessary.
Goodness me. And so, that is astonishing. So if enough people do it, then it must be okay. What's objective about that?
It's almost as if the industry determines the standards through their routine practices, and it will only be extreme deviations from the norm that historically identified as inflicting unnecessary suffering. And often these practices that were not only very cruel but also economically inefficient. But nowadays, however, legislators have actually codified these forms of abuse in the form of regulations and codes of conduct for the animal industry. And the broad notion of unnecessary suffering is now read in relation to these codes of conduct and these regulations. So provided that the infliction of suffering is permitted by a regulation or by a code of conduct, the courts will regard it as necessary suffering and therefore not unlawful. So pretty much all of the abuses that we currently associate with animal agriculture have now essentially been codified into the law.
So do you think they were really trying to push that envelope out into the courtroom?
The Crimes case is illustrative of this. Right? So Canada has some of the worst quote-unquote livestock transportation rules in the Western world. They allow for cattle to be in transit for 52 hours without access to food or water, whilst the maximum for pigs and chickens is 36 hours. And this is law that goes back to the 1970s and hasn't been updated. Animal rights activists in Canada report that animals are often transported thousands of kilometres without any food, water or shelter or any protection from the elements. The pigs that Crimes was trying to give water were suffering greatly. But we see this in the video footage of them panting and foaming at the mouth, but unable to regulate their body temperatures. Expert evidence was given at the trial that the pigs were suffering severe distress. I mean, it's not as if we need this expert evidence per se. We can see it very well for ourselves. And this evidence of this severe suffering of the pigs was used by the Crimes defense to argue that the hog farm was therefore lawfully using the animals because they were in breach of Canada's welfare standards.
Right.
And whilst Justice Harris accepted that the pigs were upset and stressed, he nevertheless did not regard there as being any evidence that they were being mistreated contrary to regulations governing the transport of pigs. And this really underscores the problem with animal welfare laws generally. They permit huge amounts of pain and suffering. In fact, Canadian philosopher and animal ethicist David Stiebel has argued that it would actually make more sense for us to refer to them not as animal welfare laws, but as animal ill-fare laws. What they really do is regulate our appalling treatment of animals rather than have the welfare of animals as their concern.
You're with Safe and Sound. I'm Sandra Kyle, and you're listening to Sarah Oliver and I talking with law expert and author Dr. Jo Wills about the Anita Quines case and animal law in general. As Dr. Wills mentioned, it's almost as if the animal industry determines the standard of animal welfare, that even when the pigs were obviously distressed and suffering, it could not be found that they were mistreated, contrary to the transport of pig codes. Some animal laws permit enormous amounts of animal suffering, and they should be called animal ill-fare, not welfare. Let's continue now with the next part of the interview.
Now, looking more broadly outside of the Canadian context, of course animal welfare standards will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and there will be some that are worse than others. But in Western countries, the unnecessary suffering standard, or something similar, is the basis for animal protection laws. And even in the best conditions, this still permits a large amount of suffering. And of course, the killing of animals doesn't really come into the debate at all. It's just taken as a given in almost all instances. Right? Now let's contrast this with human beings. When it comes to human beings, we have clear laws that prohibit assault, imprisonment, and killing of human beings. And there are only a few limited exceptions to these prohibitions. So, for example, it might be permitted to do something that would normally constitute an unlawful assault on others if you're acting in self-defense. There's a very narrow class of exceptions to a general prohibition against inflicting harm on human beings. But we contrast this with the laws that are supposed to protect animals. And we don't see this sort of strong protection. What we see is all interests of animals being subjected to a balancing act where we weigh up the interest of humans in inflicting harm on animals versus the interest of the animal in not suffering, right? So that's whether to determine the suffering is quote-unquote unnecessary or necessary. This is a really weak form of protection. And the weakness of the protection is really compounded when we consider the property status of animals and also the huge power imbalance that exists between humans and animals more generally. And I think that whilst animal welfare laws provide usually false assurances to the public that the animals they are eating were treated well before they were killed, they actually, on the whole, do very little for the animals themselves.
I think a large body of lawyers believe that incremental animal welfare laws are the way to obtain justice in the long run. I saw a debate recently with Stephen Wise, you're probably aware of him, he's an animal rights lawyer, with another well-respected lawyer, and his view against Stephen Wise's advocacy of animal personhood, and you'll speak about that in a little bit. But he was saying, in the last 25 years in the West, there have been an enormous amount of laws introduced that have improved the welfare of animals. And that is what we should continue to do. By giving animals person status, we are not only upgrading animals, we are downgrading humans. What do you say to that? Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but please tune in to the second part of the interview to hear how Dr. Wills responds to my question. I look forward to your company then. We'll go out on some more of Montego Bay Spleen. Until next time, go well, everyone. Bye-bye.